From KCRW in Los Angeles and PRI, Left, Right, and Center presents 1 year later.
1 year later.
Can you believe it's 1 year later?
1 year later.
1 year later.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Rubin, one of your hosts for the special series 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. It's the Trump era, and we're taking a new approach to political debate. Today, President Trump confounds and infuriates his political critics, but he also has many parents tearing their hair out. They want their kids to be kind, honest, and polite, but when the president is the bully in chief, what do they tell their kids? And when many feel overwhelmed, obsessed, and angry about Trump's nonstop outrages, how much should they share with their children? That's coming up on 1 year later after headlines from NPR. Check out KCRW's All News channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app. We're back with 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Jennifer Rubin, opinion writer and author of the Right Turn blog at The Washington Post. We'll have more on the Michael Flynn plea deal later in the show. Now, we're looking at parenting in the age of Trump. We start with the tumult that Trump's election set off at a Los Angeles area high school. In strongly liberal Santa Monica, students at the local high school had a hard time accepting Donald Trump's election victory and used the Pledge of Allegiance as a way to register their protest. 1 year later, students still see the pledge as a way to express their dissent.
It was Wednesday, November 9th, 2016. Donald Trump was just elected. Brandon Hall Piscasio was a senior and president of the student body at Santa Monica High School, a public school of more than 3,000 students in this beachside city on the western edge of Los Angeles.
So I was walking from my first period to my second period, and I saw like a bunch of students congregating in the science quad, and I noticed that like they were like chanting.
So I was like, what's happening? And they were like, we're not going to class, we're protesting Donald Trump being or winning the election.
This is Tyler Taylor, who was a sophomore at the time.
And so I was like, okay, like I'm down, like I'll do that too. And so I text my mom and I'm like, hey mom, I'm gonna be marked absent from third period because we're protesting. And she was just like, okay, be safe.
Hundreds of students gathered out on the quad. Principal Antonio Shelton had only been on the job for a couple of months.
I got a call. And the house principal said to me, Antonio, the students just walked out. I said, you know, why? And they were saying, because of the results of the election. And I said, so where are they? And they were saying they were in the quad. And I said, so where are we going to take them?
The administrators took the students away from the classrooms towards the outdoor amphitheater on campus. They set up a microphone and some speakers and had an impromptu assembly. This is audio a student recorded of school president Brandon Hall Piscasio speaking to the students.
One high school out here that actually cares.
Santa Monica High School has a very diverse population, both racially and economically. Over a third of the kids are Latino. Many come from immigrant families. There are a number of affluent kids from Santa Monica where the median home price is over $1 million. But there are also students who drive in from Compton and Inglewood. This multiculturalism adds to the liberalism on campus. So while Principal Shelton was surprised by the walkout, he understood why there was anger.
And as a school, I thought that it would be a great opportunity for us to learn.
But Brandon, who is Black and whose parents are from Belize, wanted to express his frustration over Trump's election another way. One of Brandon's duties as school president was to get on the intercom in the principal's office, read the daily announcements, and lead all the classrooms in reciting the Pledge of Allegiance.
As I actually looked at the words of the pledge, it was just like what he represents. Like, he doesn't represent America.
So Brandon talked it over with his mom, Allison Hall Piscasio.
He said he didn't want to do the pledge. And I said, well, that's fine. You know, you have the right to not do the pledge. That is what being American is.
California is one of only 5 states in the country that doesn't require schools to lead classes in the Pledge of Allegiance, although state law does require some sort of daily patriotic exercise. Some schools do it, some schools don't. But even if schools recite the pledge, the Supreme Court ruled that students do not have to say it or even stand for it. At Santa Monica High School, Brandon led the pledge every day. But on the morning of Thursday, November 10th, Brandon sat down at the mic in the principal's office.
I greeted the school, good morning, Santa Monica High School, so on and so forth. And usually I say, please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance, but after I greeted, I went straight into the announcements. And it ended like that.
But it didn't just end like that. Although Brandon had the support of many of the students, some teachers were upset. There were students who told parents that Brandon didn't say the pledge over the intercom, and they contacted the school. So Principal Shelton had a talk with Brandon.
That was inappropriate because this is something that we do within the culture. If this is your silent protest, this is your silent protest, and I must recognize that. But I don't want to impose that on someone else. There are students that choose to stand for the pledge, and we need to recognize and honor that.
Brandon was taken off announcements, and the student body vice president took his place at the intercom. 2 weeks later, Brandon decided that even though he still didn't want to say the pledge, he did want to go back to his job as student body president. He told Principal Shelton that he was ready to recite the pledge again.
I felt like I needed to have this time to express myself. It may have not been in the right situation, but I did it. And I'm going to continue to inspire the students at Santa Monica High School.
Now, 1 year later, it's hard to gauge whether Trump's election had any effect on the number of Santa Monica High School students who sit or stand for the pledge. Some say yes, some say no. What seems to have changed is how some students talk about the pledge. And some are obviously affected by the NFL players kneeling during the national anthem to protest racism and police brutality. Here's Tyler again.
I just don't feel like I should have to show support for a country that isn't showing support for me. Now, I think that me sitting kind of has more meaning. I'm avidly sitting down, and I'll even like put my fist up, just like Colin Kaepernick in my history class, to show more solidarity and more unity.
Tyler's mom, Makisha Franklin, says she respects her daughter's decision, though she doesn't really think it's making much of an impact.
I just feel like she should just worry about, you know, just do what you need to do while you're in high school. And then if you want to go the political route and make some changes in your community or wherever, then go for it.
School principal Antonio Shelton has this advice for parents of teenagers.
Acknowledge that their perspective is a good one, even if you don't necessarily agree with it. But acknowledging that they have a voice allows them to be successful in the future as well and not have this this attitude of no one cares.
For KCRW, I'm Jenny Hamill.
Just a side note, Santa Monica High School is the alma mater of White House senior advisor Stephen Miller. When he was a student there, he complained to the local press in 2002 that, quote, political correctness was out of control, end quote, at the school. He was a guest on conservative radio shows and recounted how he fought with school officials over the pledge not being recited daily. It was reinstated as part of the school day sometime that year. A little local color for us. I'm joined now by Mona Charon, columnist and senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Institute, and John Culhane, a professor at Delaware Law School and author of the Hey Daddy column for Slate. Hi, Mona.
Hi, how are you, Jennifer?
Nice to hear your voice. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. Let me start with you, Mona. What do you think when you hear that kids are refusing to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance?
Well, you know, what distresses me is the thought that for some of these kids, they feel that Donald Trump represents America, that because he's the president, he's the country. And I sure hope that the kids can be encouraged to see the distinction and to see that while, yes, the chief of state and the president is the chief of state in this country, and to some extent, inevitably, he does symbolize the country in certain situations, but that We have to be able to draw distinctions and say that, especially in this case, that he is not America, and that when you pledge allegiance to the flag, you're not pledging allegiance to him personally, however much he might like that.
Right. You know, that struck me as well. That's a rather sophisticated concept, even, I think, for teenage kids. Do you think that there's a long-term consequence because of this confusion? And what do you think parents and educators should be doing? Did they handle this well at Santa Monica High, in your view?
Well, I think there's a little bit of an admixture of some little bit of left-wing critique of the country in general, which you would find in a very liberal environment like Santa Monica. And so it's hard to tell how much of it is that and how much of it is specific to the Trump phenomenon. But I do think that there is a danger in people becoming jaded and becoming cynical about our country because the voters did put in office somebody who is so manifestly unfit and unsuited to the tasks of government, and because he's such a clown and such a boob in so many ways. And it's really demoralizing for a lot of people to think that that's the President of the United States. And so I think parents and educators have to make a particular effort to point out, you know, the virtues of the country that we're in. And, you know, one of the girls in that taped piece said that she didn't feel the country had done anything for her. And I would push back on that very strongly and say, no, this country has done tremendous things for all of us, and that's worth honoring.
Absolutely. It is a perplexing thing to explain to America's youth how their adult parents, supervisors, advisors landed Donald Trump in the White House. John, let me ask you about a slightly different part of the Donald Trump phenomenon, about their behavior on children and how they interact with other children. You're the father of 13-year-old twin girls. Do
right.
you worry about the message Trump is sending when he talks about women, and both to your girls, but also to young boys and men?
You know, I do worry, but, you know, I don't want to make this just about the way he talks about women, although I think that's obviously a huge problem and has set a terrible tone. And, you know, now it's coming home to roost. But my broader concern is with the whole, you know, kind of incivility and lack of
right.
basic decency that we hear. So, for example, during the entire campaign season, you know, everything from mocking, you know, a disabled reporter to, you know, accusing all Mexicans of being rapists. I mean, there were just a lot of things that we felt very uncomfortable exposing our children to. And, of course, it's a paradox, right? Because you want them to
right.
be involved. They're old enough, I think. I mean, they were sort of at an age where, you know, you're kind of on the cusp of how protective to be, right? You know, I was torn because on the one hand, I felt like a lot of what was being said was not suitable for them to hear. On the other hand, I felt like they absolutely needed to hear it because, you know, there was a chance that Trump could become the president. And I wanted them to, you know, understand what the stakes were and what these things meant. So I think it's very tricky. And I think what I'm describing, you know, plays out in all kinds of contexts, including in what's going on in Santa Monica. It's just difficult to know what to do and how to
sure.
kind of pull apart those different pieces.
Sure. Although the three of us probably think that Donald Trump is a terrible influence on our children, not everyone agrees. We invited some listeners to weigh in on topics we're covering on 1 year later. Here is a Trump supporter who sees Trump as a good role model for children. Let's listen to Raymond Briones.
My name is Raymond Briones. I'm the head trainer of the Ultimate Warriors Boxing Academy in Ontario, California. My dad's on his side of the family were from Mexico. My mom's side were Apache and Arapaho. But then I had my grandfather's side were German and French also. I think since the last 8 years, we had no strength in the White House. We had somebody who was the daddy who gave out candy to everybody. Trump steps up, says, no more candy. I'm not giving any freebies out. I'm going to make you respect the country. I'm going to make you respect your flag. I'm going to make you respect your veterans. And people don't want to be told what to do because it was so used to giving everything that they wanted. There was no, it was all, everything was yes. And now Trump says, hey, I don't understand why people are turning against Trump. because in the national anthem, he's just telling people, respect your flag, respect your country, respect your veterans. What is wrong with that?
Mona, what would you say to someone like Raymond? Does he have a point, or is he missing the bigger picture?
Well, I do hear sentiments like that fairly frequently, that they perceive Trump's grandstanding about the national anthem, for example, as being patriotic. And look, I do understand the perception that Obama was both weak and preachy, and I get that. I thought the same. I don't think that the answer is to have someone who is so clearly exploiting patriotic themes for partisan purposes. I mean, one of the great uniting things about patriotism is exactly that it shouldn't be partisan, that it should be a place where we can all meet. And in his hands, he has sullied it by making a big issue. By the way, the whole kneeling thing at the NFL, I mean, that it had already begun to peter out. It was not that big of a deal, but he seized upon it because it was a chance to just sort of wave the flag and make a big fuss about something as a symbol. And I think also, if we're being completely honest, there was a racial element to it, you know, because sure. He was going after black football players, and a lot of his supporters like that sort of thing. Oh, you know, those rich black players and their lack of gratitude and so on and so forth. So I think the way Trump did it was ugly and divisive. And, you know, that is a shame because it's more than a shame. It's repellent. The fact is that when you invoke patriotic symbols, you should do it with the utmost respect and in the most uniting way you can, because God forbid people should begin to think that that being patriotic is a partisan matter.
Right. We're going to have to leave it there for just a minute. We're going to take a quick break. We will come back with more on parenting in the Trump era, and then a discussion about Michael Flynn's plea today. This is One Year Later from KCRW. I'm Jennifer Rubin, and this is One Year Later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. I want to remind you, you can also hear us at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Today, we're talking about parenting in the age of Trump, but some adult children are also struggling with how Trump has impacted their relationship with their parents. Here's one listener who called to tell us her story. This is the second holiday season that she's not attending her family's dinners because of politics.
My name is Allison, and I'm from San Diego, California, and I struggle with interesting back-and-forth relationship with my mom and stepdad because we both have different political views, and over the years, it hasn't been such a big deal that it stopped me from visiting or, you know, enjoying my time spending with my mom and my stepdad until last year when I was under the impression that they were not Trump supporters, but they were on the anti-Hillary bandwagon. I myself was a Bernie supporter, and we would, you know, have family-like teasing involved and mostly revolving around me being the only liberal or the one with the Obama sticker or the Bernie sticker on my car. And for the most part, I just, you know, tongue-in-cheek, just kind of would laugh and what have you. And I was living in Los Angeles at the time. Now that I moved back to San Diego, last year being the first holiday season, when I understood that my mom actually chose to vote for Trump the day of the election, I felt like a bomb dropped or, you know, a huge weight just like fell on me. I was shocked. And I actually told her, I can't even look at you right now. And she was so offended that I even said that. And so it was just a couple weeks before Thanksgiving, and I just decided to work. I drive for Lyft and Uber, and I just chose to do that day instead of joining for Thanksgiving because it was going to be with my mom, my stepdad, and his sons, which they all have the same political views.
Wow. Wow. That was Allison, who can't even attend holiday dinners with her family anymore. Mona, we all did just come through the Thanksgiving season. What should families do in these situations? Have we really gotten to the point where we can't sit down and have a meal with family members who have different political views, even if they're supporting a candidate that we think is morally obnoxious?
These are very, very difficult times. There's no question about it. And I think we've all dealt with it to one degree or another. I mean, speaking for myself, I will say that I was pretty crushed to find many friends, you know, avidly right. supporting Trump. I understood people who said, well, I'm going to hold my nose and vote for him. I didn't understand the people who became downright enthusiastic. That much having been said, I've grappled with this a lot, and I've decided that that as much as we may profoundly disagree, and I may be disappointed in friends and relatives who come to different conclusions, that unless we were in a situation where, you know, people were actually being persecuted or put in camps or, God forbid, you know, that right. this is not worth sacrificing either a lifelong friendship or a relative a relationship with a relative over. It's just not. So you talk about other things. You talk cooking or sports or something else, and just avoid the topic of politics.
Sadly, I think that's right. I think we've kind of stopped discussing these things. I, for one, grew up at a household where politics was the topic of conversation around the dinner table. I suspect
right.
that's not the case in most places in America. John, Mona raises an interesting issue, which is, do parents risk oversharing with their kids? In other words, putting
yeah.
all of their anxieties, their hatred, their emotional baggage onto their kids, particularly if their kids are young children, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. What's your take on that?
You know, it's a great question. And we had a community meeting last night. We've been sort of mobilizing to figure out what to do in response to what's going on in the country. I live in a pretty fairly liberal enclave here in Philadelphia. And I was asking people, you know, how do you handle this? And there was a variety of responses, and one woman said, I come home every day and I say to her kids, she's got a middle schooler and a high schooler, you know, I only cursed Trump's name 4 times today and blah, 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 and I want them to know how I'm feeling. And I'm thinking, you know, I already feel this too much. I mean, I, you know, feel like sometimes I need to disengage, and it's hard to do. And to bring my children into it, I don't think, at least for me, is not the appropriate way to go. So I wait for them. And there are plenty of times when they'll say things about, well, what's Trump doing and, you know, what's going on with the environment, which I think is one of the most serious issues we're facing. And I do think it's you know, extinction level. So for me, you know, I wait for them to come forward because I don't want to be the parent who's kind of pushing all this stuff on my kids as strongly as I feel about it. I do think, you know, I want them to get involved and to do things, but I don't, you know, it's a difficult balance to draw because I do feel very strongly about these things. But I, at the same time, am hoping, you know, they're 13 and they're starting to develop their own sense of right and wrong and priorities. And also just who's going to like the middle school dance tonight. So that's a lot of it at this age. And I don't want that to be, you know, occluded by all this other stuff that's extremely important to me. It's important to them, but maybe to a lesser extent, and I'm trying to take my cue from them.
Right. Mona, your kids are a little older than my kids. You have gone through a parenting dilemma before with a president, with Bill Clinton. What is different about this, and did anything that you did or didn't do during the Bill Clinton scandals affect how you're trying to navigate through this presidency?
Well, let me just start by saying that I agree with John about the, like, overloading children with our own
right.
Preoccupations and so on. And, you know, one of the things that I've never liked is when you would see, for example, at a political protest, you know, some little kid, 6, 7-year-old kid with a big sandwich board saying something
right.
political. And, you know, the poor thing. I mean, they're not old enough to have come to that decision by themselves. So their parents are just using them as props. And I don't like that. I resist that. I actually even resisted sharing, you know, trying to get my children to adopt my views, because I just felt that it was disrespectful to them. Just let them come to their own conclusions. I obviously knew what I thought, but anyway. But
you're a better parent than I, by the way, Mona, on that score. But go ahead.
I don't know. You know what? And I don't know whether it would have made any difference anyway. You know, they're individuals and they come to their own conclusions. But in any case, the thing about the Clinton years was that, and that's somewhat, there is a little overlap, I think, with what we're experiencing now, or certainly if parents have, you know, young children like John does, and you do, you know, one of the things that happened during the Clinton years is you didn't want your kids to hear the news. You know, you want it was X-rated, right? You know, you didn't want to have too many close questions from a young child about what Monica Lewinsky was exactly doing with Bill Clinton in the Oval Office. And so, so it became, you know, this kind of surreal experience where, you know, not only did you have to monitor what your kids were watching in terms of entertainment, but you had to be really careful to hit the, you know, remote control if the news came on. And it's similar, you know, with this era and the Clinton versus Trump campaign and all of the dredging up of the old scandals and the Access Hollywood tape and so on and so forth. So, you know, it is somebody wrote a book a few years ago, something about, you know, how to raise G-rated kids in an X-rated world, which was a great title. I didn't read the actual book, but it is actually, you know, it just gets more and more difficult.
Right. And now we have a candidate running for Senate who's accused of terrible things involving children, and it gets worse and worse.
Yeah.
John, Mona raises the great point about kids and how they process media. Now, parents have much less control, frankly, over the media that these kids process. Do you think being on social media, that they pick up some of the bad behavior we see acted out, the incivility, the nastiness, forget about the bad spelling. We're just talking about how they interact with individuals. Tell us a little bit about what you think about that.
Well, we have not allowed our seventh graders to be on social media yet. And it's more because of some of the stuff that we've read about the very negative effects, especially at this age, and especially for girls, it seems, that, you know, being in middle school and being exposed to particularly Instagram seems to be an issue, and Snapchat. So they've asked us several times if they can do that, and we've said no. So we are being a little bit, you know, more conservative in that way. We also say they are not to watch, you know, YouTube videos unless we're in the room, because it's the Wild West, and it's very difficult to know what they're consuming. So we're trying to keep an eye on it, and basically what they're doing in their room, if they're doing anything in addition to homework, is listening to music. And I know what they're listening to, and it's, you know, it's pretty innocuous, you know, sort of pop stuff. But it is difficult, and I know parents struggle with it, and I'm constantly asking parents, well, do you allow your kids on social media? The flip side of that is, you know, if they're getting their news and other useful information from their iPhones, that's not social media, you want to make sure they can get that. They're old enough now to consume some of that, but if they're going to be reading about what Roy Moore is alleged to have done, for instance, or for that matter, Trump, or I could name, you know, other people on the left. I mean, it's been an explosion. You know, I want them to have some context and to talk to us or to some responsible adult about it, and not just read it and you know, take it on board and not really understand the context. So it's very challenging, I think, to, you know, to get through all of that with them.
Mona, you raised your kids during an era where there wasn't Twitter and there wasn't some of this social media. Do you think that would have changed how you parented, or changed perhaps the stakes because of what goes on in social media?
Well, it was pretty close. I mean, we certainly had the internet. We certainly had the problem of monitoring what the boys were seeing. I knew that, you know, it was possible for them to see all kinds of really destructive and corrupting things. And so one solution that we did, but because this was pre-cell phone, you know, pre-smartphone era.
Right.
So, you know, our kids had to use the computer in the big kitchen area that we had, and so that I could be seeing what they were seeing on the screen. And it's obviously gotten more challenging. I guess,
right.
You know, maybe some of those, maybe some of the programs that are, you know, that allow parents to screen material is perhaps somewhat helpful. But, I mean, from what I have heard, you know, from parents with younger children, it's practically impossible to set up real barriers to them seeing bad things. And so the most important thing that from what I've gathered is to talk with them about it, to make sure that they know they can come to you about anything they've seen or heard and that they can talk it through with you, because parents are a really important filter in terms of just not necessarily blocking what the kids see, although that if you can, great, but if you can't, that you give them your moral perspective and your wisdom and your experience, because for children, everything is fresh, and the emotional wallop of new things for a child is so much greater than for somebody who's older, and it can be really shattering.
Absolutely. John, in our last minute or so together, tell us what you tell your girls about, if you will, male chivalry or male civility towards women. We have a president who embodies every bad quality we can think of in that regard. Are you trying not to lower their expectations for the behavior they're going to encounter as they get older?
Well, you know, what we're trying to do, and I know this is a word that, you know, people are sick of hearing, but we try to empower them both in terms of giving them, you know, confidence, putting them in situations where they'll be challenged and, you know, might fail sometimes, but will succeed, whether that's sports or encouraging them to do, you know, different activities at school, so that they, you know, they have a sense of, you know, sort of who they are. And then expressing to them that, you know, things are not worth their compromising that kind of essential core of themselves. And we have talked a little bit about what's going on with Trump, you know, and harassment. And they're sort of appalled. They don't really, they're just at that age. I mean, they just turned 13 last month. So they're just at the age where this stuff is starting to make some sense to them. And so we're kind of introducing it like, you know, through an IV drip, very measured way. And then, you know, responding to their questions, which they do have. And as Mona says, you know, sort of being with them when we can, if there's a movie or something we're watching as a family, to, you know, to sort of comment on it and get their reaction and, you know, all different things. So it's a much more complex strategy than maybe what was required even a generation ago.
Right. We're going to have to leave it there, but I would note the irony of a White House that is held by a party that used to embody family values has now made it especially difficult on families to communicate values to their kids. But we will leave it there. Thanks to my guests, Mona Charon and John Culhane. When we come back, our Talk It Out segment today, more on Michael Flynn's guilty plea when we continue with One Year Later. I'm Jennifer Rubin, back with One Year Later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. This is the part of the show when we talk it out, when we talk through the big political stories of the day with two political viewpoints. Since I'm representing the right, we're bringing in Max Bergman from the Center on American Progress, where he focuses on European security and U.S.-Russia policy. He served in the Obama State Department and is our voice from the left today. Hi, Max.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, very good. Wow, what big news today. You were in the State Department at the time some of the events concerning Michael Flynn were going on. Tell us a little bit about this transition period when the Obama administration believed Russia had been hacking and believed that they had been interfering with our electoral process. And at the same time, Michael Flynn was apparently having all kinds of conversations with them that we didn't know about.
Yeah, you know, at the time, on December 29th, when Barack Obama announced the sanctions on Russia, we were all in the State Department expecting a response. We were expecting some of our diplomats to be sent home. And then we were just totally floored when completely out of character, Vladimir Putin did nothing and just turned the other cheek. That is just not his MO. That is not how he operated. We were expecting a stronger response. And, you know, shortly, a few weeks after, we then learned from David Ignatius that there was back-channel communication.
David Ignatius is a columnist for The Washington Post who writes on foreign policy.
Yes.
Go ahead.
That there was back-channel communication between the Trump transition team and Mike Flynn specifically and the Russian government. And so then it all started to make sense. And also in the intervening period, I think that was January 12th, when that column came out, we had the intelligence community report on January 6th, and then the release of the Steele dossier on December 10th. So, you know, us in government, we were also having this kind of whirlwind experience of being like, wait, what? How does this, what's going on? And so what, you know, now nearly a year later, we're getting a lot of clarity. And that, I think, is why, you know, this Mueller investigation is so important, to get to the bottom of what happened here. And what is clear now from this indictment is that Flynn was lied to the FBI, and we still don't quite know why he lied to the FBI about doing what he did, because there weren't additional charges related to this. But we now have a sense that this went really deep into the Trump transition team, into the Trump campaign, because Flynn was checking back with Mar-a-Lago for sort of guidance on what to do here. So this is now sort of, you know, I'm thinking back to the days at the end of December, and it's now everything is making a lot more sense now.
Or not, as the case may yes. be. Now, Flynn was apparently, at least this is what we learned from the indictment, trying to work out some kind of deal or arrangement with Russia that they would help us find ISIS. But in exchange for what? Do you understand what Flynn was trying to bargain here?
No. And frankly, I think there's very little actually that the Russians had to offer the United States in terms of tangible policy benefits. There is no real grand bargain that's in the interest of the United States. And there's been a lot of other reporting that has recently emerged about Flynn being engaged in some cockamamie nuclear plan to work with the Russians and Saudi Arabia to build civilian nuclear power plants throughout the Middle East. And so it looks like there may be a business dimension to this, that there was going to be a financial component that was going to benefit perhaps Flynn himself, but also perhaps many other people associated with Trump. And that is why I think this Mueller investigation is so critical, because what were the motives behind what Flynn was doing? And just what it seems like is that this, you know, if we talk about quid pro quo, that the Russians clearly intervened in our election, and that the essential, you know, they were intervening on behalf of the Trump. They were trying to elect Donald Trump. There was an immense right. benefit to Donald Trump, what they were doing. So what was the payback for the Russians? Flynn and what he's talking about here and what Mueller is getting at is starting to look like the quo in this, that this is the payback. This is talking about sanctions, about how we're going to get rid of sanctions on the Russians. And we have to remember that these sanctions were presidential. They were executive branch sanctions that were put on Russia because of its invasion and occupation of Ukraine. And the president, President Trump, could unilaterally get rid of them. And so the Russians were keenly focused on trying to get the Trump administration to do that, or the Trump transition team to commit to doing that.
Right. There's a lot of evidence now that when they came in, they did try to scramble and lift those sanctions and were kind of thwarted over at the State Department. And that nicely brings us to our second big story, which is Rex Tillerson may finally be ending his tenure at the State Department. Is that a good thing for America? Is that a good thing for the State Department?
Yeah, we're sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place a little bit. I think Rex Tillerson leaving would be extremely beneficial to the actual State Department, that he has been a total disaster. His quote-unquote reorganization, and the reason why I put it in quotes, is because what this really was about shrinking, about deconstructing the building. He came in immediately and wanted to implement massive budget cuts and a culling of the staff, firing lots of people, shrinking the amount of people coming in. And so I think it's likely that if he's replaced by Pompeo, that there will be more.
Pompeo would be Mike Pompeo.
Mike Pompeo, the CIA current director, the current CIA director, that there would be a rebuilding kind of the capacity and capability of the State Department. Pompeo has a very good relationship with Donald Trump. But on the other hand, it makes war with Iran, I think, a lot more likely. Pompeo is a real hawk. And Tillerson, one of the key things that I think he's accomplished, probably one of the only things, is that he admitted the reality that the Iranians are upholding the nuclear deal. And so if Pompeo were to be Secretary of State, there's another strong voice for potential military action with Iran. So it may be beneficial to the State Department itself that we may stop the gutting of America's diplomatic capability, which is hugely important, but it could also have other dangerous consequences.
Right. And if the CIA slot is backfilled, as some of the news reports suggest, with Tom Cotton, that introduces another super hawk into the administration. Would Tom Cotton, as CIA director, give you cold sweats at night?
Oh, absolutely. And another reason why he gives me cold sweats is partly because of his positioning on the Trump investigation, the Russia investigation, where he's taken this extremely disdainful attitude towards it and seems to not think that this is much of a problem or much of a challenge. And given that the U.S. intelligence community, and specifically the CIA, has been front and center in trying to counter what Russia is doing here in the United States. It gives me great pause that he's the person to lead that agency. And also, given his age and relative inexperience, he's a senator, but he's 40 years old. I think there's a lot of questions that have to be asked about if he's the right person to lead this agency, particularly given all that is going to be happening, I think, around the Russia investigation in the coming year, that we don't want to have a sort of a political plant at the CIA, particularly when we're entering potentially a dangerous period in terms of this scandal.
Right. It's interesting, when I talked to former acting CIA directors, which I did yesterday, and asked them about this, some of them raised, well, we had George H.W. Bush, who was head of CIA. He was a politician. And I guess I'm tempted to repeat the line of Senator Benson, which is, this guy is no George H.W. Bush. It's different, I think, when you have an extremely aggressive, extremely partisan senator, as opposed to someone who was really already very well versed in foreign policy and took a much more level-headed view of things. Do you think we should gain any solace from the past experience, or is this going to be another bad decision by the Trump administration?
Well, I think putting Tom Cotton in charge of the CIA would be a very bad decision. And I think the George H.W. Bush example is a worthy one, where you had, a centrist, bipartisan leaning at the time politician, and put him in charge of the intelligence agency was not one that I, at least, from my recollection, was not controversial. I think putting someone like Tom Cotton, who has been sort of at the hard edge on these political fights over national security, sends a signal that you're politicizing the agency. It's clear where his views are, and evidence to the contrary doesn't seem to actually persuade him. And one of the key features of being the head of the CIA is that you need to call it like you need to call him like you see him. It can't be can't be viewed through the prism of ideology, and that is where in the past the CIA has gotten into a lot of trouble, where it's overextended its bounds, where it's pursued policies and put forth intelligence that was misleading and led to bad policy actions. It's very critical that the CIA be a source of intelligence, not a source of partisan intelligence.
We hear, just in the time that we've been on the air, that NBC News is reporting that the very senior transition team member who told Flynn to go talk to Kislyak, that would be the Russian ambassador, was none other than Jared Kushner. Is Jared Kushner now on the hot seat in 5 seconds or so? What do you think?
Absolutely. What we have to realize is Jared Kushner ran the digital campaign, the Trump campaign, which And that is going to be a key focus of Mueller. And that would have been a key venue for the for potential collusion between the Trump digital campaign and what the Russians were also doing online digitally.
Gotcha. Well, the plot thickens, as they say. Thank you. That was my guest for the Talk It Out section of the program, Max Bergman. Thanks, Max, for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
One Year Later is a co-production of KCRW, Los Angeles, and Public Radio International. We leave you with Pink Floyd's Another Brick in the Wall.
PRI, Public Radio International.